This audio is from Radio New Zealand. To find out more, visit radionz.co.nz.
It's a huge pleasure to be here in New Zealand for the first time. I've spent a lot of time in Australia, so it's nice to finally get it to New Zealand. And it's especially an honor to give the Sir Michael King lecture today. Michael King was a historian who reached out to many people, reached way beyond the bounds of academic history to speak to his fellow New Zealanders. And as a historian, I've always felt the importance of writing in a way that can be accessible to anyone who's interested in the subject. I feel passionately that history doesn't just inform us about the past, but it informs us about the present, that it tells us about who we are and where we are and why we think the things we do because of the things that have happened before. And I think nowhere is this more true than in the debate over climate change. So with that, I'd like to start. In 2005, my Austrian governor said, and I won't attempt an Austrian accent, "I say the debate is over. We know the science, we see the threat, and we know the time for action is now." Now, it's not every day you get to agree with a politician, but I believe that my governor was correct about climate change. And in the mid-2000s, it seemed that my fellow American citizens had gotten the message about the science that demonstrated the reality of human-caused climate change. In 2007, the Yale Project on Climate Change, working with the Gallup polling organization, found that 72% of American citizens were completely or mostly convinced that global warming was underway. 62% of us believed that life on Earth would continue without major disruption only if society took immediate and drastic action to reduce global warming. And it wasn't just environmentalists who were sounding the alarm, it was the Pentagon too. In 2003, a major report from the Pentagon on abrupt climate change warned that once temperature rises above a threshold, adverse weather conditions could develop rather abruptly, and with inadequate preparation, the result could be a significant drop in the human carrying capacity of the Earth's environment. Indeed, even many former skeptics and contrarians had come around. One of these was Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and strategist, who said in 2006, "It's now 2006, so he was off to a good start. He got the date right. "I think most people would conclude that there is global warming taking place and the behavior of humans is affecting the climate." Now, Luntz is important to our story because he was the author of a 2003 memo to Republican candidates running for office in the United States in which he advised them to use the phrase climate change rather than global warming because, he said, climate change is a lot less frightening. Polls consistently showed that the Republican Party was considered vulnerable on environmental issues because polls showed that the American people did care about the environment and did believe the government had a role to play in protecting it, but they viewed Republicans as less concerned about the environment than Democrats. And so he advised Republican candidates to emphasize scientific uncertainty, to insist that there was no scientific consensus and we didn't really know if global warming was underway. He wrote, "The scientific debate remains open. Voters believe there's no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, then their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate." Now, was Luntz's position factually correct? Was the scientific debate still open? The answer is no. 2 years before, in 2001, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's leading organization of expert scientific researchers, had concluded, quote, "Human activities are modifying the concentration of atmosphere constituents that absorb or scatter radiant energy. Most of the observed warming over the previous 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations." Now, in fact, the science had actually coalesced even earlier. 6 years before, in 1995, the IPCC in its second assessment report had concluded that the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human impact on global climate. My own historical research and analysis of the peer-reviewed published scientific literature showed that scientists indeed had had a consensus on the reality of human-caused climate change by the early 1990s. Now, this result surprised many people, but it really should not have. In fact, I would argue as a historian that we Americans seem to suffer from a kind of historical amnesia, because almost all of us seem to have forgotten that the United States is a signatory to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which commits the nations of the world to preventing dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And when President George H.W. Bush signed the Framework Convention in 1992, he called on world leaders to translate the written document into concrete action to protect the planet. So what happened? Why didn't the world take those concrete steps that our first President Bush promised us? What I'd like to do today is to give you a very brief summary of the history of climate science and some of the key developments, and then to tell you the story of the emergence of a political challenge to that scientific evidence. It's a story of selling uncertainty to stave off government action and government regulation. So the story begins with John Tyndall, the Irish experimentalist who first established what it means for something to be a greenhouse gas. In a series of experiments, Tyndall showed that certain gases, most importantly water vapor and carbon dioxide, have a unique and significant property. They're highly transparent to visible light, but rather opaque to infrared. And this, he recognized, was by and large a good thing, because without greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the Earth would be as cold as the Moon or Mars and quite inhospitable for life. Now, about 40 years later, Svante Arrhenius, a Swedish geochemist, realized that when you burn fossil fuels like coal, carbon dioxide is produced as a byproduct. And therefore, the burning of fossil fuels could increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, increase the amount of warming, and lead to warming of the Earth overall. Arrhenius did the first calculations of what the impact of doubling carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would be and calculated that it would increase the average temperature of the globe between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. Now, Arrhenius was Swedish, so he thought global warming would be a good thing. The first person to suggest that it might not be, you know, these whinging palms, was a Brit by the name of Guy Stewart Callender. And in 1938, he published the first peer-reviewed scientific article suggesting that carbon dioxide was increasing from burning fossil fuels and that therefore the temperature of the globe might be increasing too. Now that was 1938. The following year, he became occupied with war work, as did many scientists around the globe. The scientific community did not really come back to the issue in a serious and sustained way until the late 1950s. But then scientists began to think about the question again, particularly in the context of the International Geophysical Year, and the question of what kinds of systematic measurements, geophysical measurements, should scientists be taking as part of the IGY. Two leading scientists involved in the International Geophysical Year, Hans Zuse and Roger Revelle, suggested that we should measure carbon dioxide, and we should measure it specifically because of the possibility that increasing CO2 was changing the climate of the planet. And they wrote, now famously, that mankind was performing a great geophysical experiment by returning to the atmosphere carbon dioxide that had been stored in rocks over the course of hundreds of millions of years of geological time. The man who made that CO2 measurements into his life work was Charles David Keeling, a professor at the University of California, where I teach today. In 1958, as part of the International Geophysical Year, Keeling began the systematic, steady measurement of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And within just a few years, the Keeling curve, as it came to be known, had started to emerge. And by 1965, Dave himself had concluded that his data showed that carbon dioxide was indeed increasing. And so he and Revelle and a number of other scientists began to try to communicate this message about the increase in carbon dioxide, about its potential significance to political leaders. In 1965, as part of the U.S. President's Science Advisory Committee, they wrote, "By the year 2000, there will be about 25% more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere than at present, and this will modify the heat budget of the atmosphere to such an extent that marked changes in climate could occur." This message reached the White House under President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who said in a special message to Congress, "This generation has altered the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels." Now, I don't have time tonight to talk about all the important scientific developments that then began to ensue, but the most important of them was the invention and the rise of computer modeling. Scientists began to develop computer models that made it possible for them to simulate the atmosphere of the Earth, the climate system, and to see what the effect of increased carbon dioxide would be. And doing this, using computers to simulate the atmosphere, these scientists began to conclude that indeed Arrhenius and Callender and Suess and Revel were correct. That sooner or later, with the rise of carbon dioxide that Keeling had measured, sooner or later global warming would be expected to occur. This consensus was expressed in many different places around the globe, but perhaps most pithily by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, who in 1979 wrote, "A plethora of studies from diverse sources indicates a consensus that climate changes will result from man's combustion of fossil fuels and changes in land use." The big question was when. Most scientists in 1979 thought "will result" meant perhaps by the year 2000, or perhaps even later. A few mavericks suggested the change was perhaps already underway. So, for example, in 1981, John Perry, the chief staff officer at the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Climate Research Board, wrote, "Physically, a doubling of CO2 is no magic threshold. If we have good reason to believe that a 100% increase in carbon dioxide will produce significant impacts on climate, then we must have equally good reason to suspect that even the small increase we have already produced may have subtly altered our climate." Thus, he concluded, climate change is not a matter for the next century. We are most probably doing it right now. Well, was Perry right? Were changes already underway? Roger Revel addressed that question the following year, in which he wrote, "Mathematical models of the world's climate system indicate that the answer is probably yes, but an unambiguous climate signal has not yet been detected." So the big shock to the scientific community, the big surprise, was when only 6 years later, that unambiguous climate signal was indeed detected. In 1988, NASA climate modeler James Hansen and his team published an article in which they concluded that that unambiguous climate signal, the fingerprint of human activities on the Earth's climate, was now discernible. That summer, Hansen testified to this effect in the U.S. Congress, in which he declared that he was 99% certain that climate change was now detectable. And it was this emerging and indeed disturbing conclusion that climate change was actually happening faster and sooner than scientists had predicted that had led to the creation in 1988 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It also led the New York Times to say that the issue of an overheating world had suddenly moved to the forefront of public concern. But it also led to something else. At the same time that the scientific evidence, the scientific understanding was coalescing, so too was emerging a politically motivated campaign to cast doubt upon that science. The campaign focused on the claim that the science was not settled, that there wasn't a consensus, and therefore it would be premature to act. As a historian, I'm interested in origins, and the origins of this claim can be traced back to a surprisingly small handful of people. Now, today, as many of you know, there are attacks on climate science from many quarters around the globe, in the United States, in Europe, here in Australia, and New Zealand. But one of the most important sources of challenges to the scientific evidence, going back to this period in the late 1980s, is a think tank in Washington, D.C. called the George C. Marshall Institute. For more than two decades, the Marshall Institute has either denied the reality of human-caused climate change or has insisted that if climate change is happening, it's not the result of human activities. As recently as 2007, the Institute quoted Timothy Ball, a Canadian climatologist, arguing that the widely propagated fact that humans are contributing to global warming is the greatest deception in the history of science. Evidently, Canadians have never heard of Piltdown Man. So where did the Marshall Institute come from? Why do they promote doubt about climate science? Well, the Marshall Institute was founded by three men. They were all physicists. They were all very prominent, very intelligent, actually brilliant. And they had all built their careers in Cold War weapons and rocketry programs. Robert Jastrow, the head of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, worked extensively in the U.S. space program, including the Apollo missions to the moon. William Nirenberg, a nuclear physicist who had worked on the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, on isotope separation of the fuel for the Manhattan Project, for the atomic bomb, and later became the head of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, where he directed a number of Navy-sponsored projects in oceanography, mainly focused on acoustic detection of Soviet submarines. Fred Seitz, perhaps the leading solid-state physicist of his generation, he had worked on the hydrogen bomb, risen to prominence as head of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and then become president of the prestigious Rockefeller University in New York City. These men had served together on a number of advisory and policy committees, giving advice to the U.S. president and other high-level organizations, NATO, Congress, and the like. And in the 1980s, they found themselves serving together on an advisory committee to the Reagan administration on the question of the Strategic Defense Initiative, what most of us remember as Star Wars. In 1984, they created the Marshall Institute to defend the Strategic Defense Initiative against a scientist boycott of it. Some of you in the room will remember that Star Wars was controversial, not least of all because it was a departure from the Cold War doctrine of mutual assured destruction. Most scientists said it wasn't feasible, technically, but even if it were, it was a bad idea because it would be destabilizing. Because one side, if they had an effective defensive shield, might be tempted to launch a first strike, and therefore mutual destruction would no longer be assured, and we might be on our way to Armageddon. And for this reason, more than 6,500 American scientists and engineers signed a petition declaring a boycott of program funds. This was historically unprecedented in the Cold War. Individual scientists had sometimes chosen to decline to work on weapons programs, but the American scientific community as a whole had never made that choice. Needless to say, this greatly disturbed the Reagan administration, and it also disturbed Jastrow, Nirenberg, and Seitz, who, against the majority of their technical colleagues, supported SDI, believing it was feasible, necessary, and even urgent. Indeed, they wrote numerous articles between 1984 and 1989, defending the need for SDI on the grounds that the Soviet Union was threatening to overtake the United States in technical and military prowess. Now, at the time, Frederick Seitz had retired from the Rockefeller University, and he had taken on one last job. And that job was working as a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Corporation. The principal strategy that the tobacco industry used to defend its product against the scientific evidence of its dangers was doubt-mongering. To insist that there were many causes of lung cancer, so no one person's lung cancer could ever be definitively attributed to smoking. And therefore, because we didn't really know, it would be inappropriate and premature for governments to act to regulate tobacco use. In 1989, these two strands of the story merged. The Cold War ended. The Berlin Wall came down. And these men who had dedicated their lives to fighting the Soviet Union, to protecting the United States against the perceived threat of the Soviet Union, might have been happy. They might have been content that their life's work had achieved the goal that they had wished. But they weren't. They weren't content. Like generals who couldn't lay down their arms, they insisted on finding a new enemy. And that new enemy, that new set of reds under the beds, were environmentalists, who they considered to be extremists, and who they believed were exaggerating environmental threats in order to pursue a left-wing political agenda. And they applied the tobacco strategy, which Frederick Seitz had learned working with R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, to insist that the science was still unsettled. "Doubt is our product," ran the infamous memo written by one tobacco industry executive in 1969, "since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public." Well, if doubt was their product, these scientists supplied it. And not just about the harms of tobacco. Over and over again, these men became serial contrarians, supplying doubt on a whole range of issues, beginning with tobacco and running through the threat of nuclear winter, the reality of acid rain, the severity of the ozone hole, and most importantly, the human causes of global warming. In addition, recently there's been a kind of revisionist historical attack on the science related to DDT. The physicists in our story cast doubt on every one of these issues, and the playbook was always the same, to insist that the science was too uncertain to justify government or individual action. What I'd like to spend the rest of the afternoon today talking about is why they did it. Because for Eric Conway and I, when we were writing this story, this was the question that we wanted to answer. We wanted to know why a group of scientists, prominent, successful, distinguished scientists, would attack the work of their own colleagues, in some cases even people that they themselves had hired at their own institutions. And the short answer is ideological. It's the ideology that they carried through the Cold War and beyond, the ideology of free market fundamentalism, the belief in the power of markets, free markets, to solve all problems. Free market fundamentalism is probably best understood as a kind of end member of a spectrum of belief that we can broadly categorize as modern neoliberalism, the idea of deregulating markets in order to release the so-called magic of the marketplace. These ideas came to prominence in the early 1980s, around the same time that our story is getting going, promoted particularly in the United Kingdom by Margaret Thatcher and in the United States by Ronald Reagan. But it wasn't just Republicans and Tories. A broad consensus emerged throughout the 1990s, promoted as well by Democrat Bill Clinton and Labor leader Tony Blair, which came to be known as the Washington Consensus. The intellectual roots of modern neoliberalism can be found in the work of two key thinkers, Chicago economist Milton Friedman and Austrian neoliberal economists Friedrich Hayek. In 1962, Friedman wrote a book that was deeply influential in American conservative circles, a book entitled Capitalism and Freedom. And I find it interesting that this was published in 1962, right around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, probably the coldest moment of the Cold War. In this book, Friedman argued that capitalism and freedom were two sides of the same coin, that if you wanted to have political freedom, you had to have economic freedom as well. Because without economic freedom, once governments stepped in to control markets, it was only a matter of time before they began to control other things as well. And we'd be on the slippery slope to tyranny, the road to serfdom. Friedman acknowledges his own debt to Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, published in 1944, in which Hayek made essentially the same argument and became a passionate opponent not just of Soviet-style dictatorial or totalitarian communism, but even of liberal democratic, social democratic, Western European social democracy, fearing that it too would put us on the road to serfdom. The contrarians in our story took this argument even one step further, arguing that environmentalism was the slippery slope to socialism, the road to serfdom. Why? Well, because environmentalists in general did tend to argue for regulation, for governments intervening in the marketplace to prevent the damage caused by things like tobacco or acid rain. And they argued, they believed that from the regulation of acid rain or secondhand smoke, it was only a matter of time before we would be heading towards government control of our lives more generally. This idea can be found articulated in many contrarian writings. My students are constantly sending me clippings from newspapers, even today, where we see this argument articulated. But it was perhaps articulated most clearly by a fourth scientist who joined the cause also in the 1980s, this man, S. Fred Singer. Singer's biography is remarkably similar to the other three. He was also a Cold War physicist. In fact, he was the proverbial rocket scientist, having worked in the 1950s on U.S. rocketry programs and become the first director of the U.S. Weather Satellite Service. And like the other three, he was involved in campaigns to challenge the evidence of acid rain, global warming, and the ozone hole. And like Frederick Seitz, he also defended tobacco. In the early 1990s, Singer worked with the Philip Morris Tobacco Company to attack the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency over the issue of secondhand smoke. In 1993, he published an article with a lawyer named Kent Jeffries entitled EPA and the Science of Environmental Tobacco Smoke. Jeffries was a lawyer affiliated with the Libertarian Cato Institute in the United States and also the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a free market advocacy organization. But the report was published by the Alexis de Tocqueville Institute with funding from the Tobacco Institute. So we begin to see now an important and key development in the story, that it begins with one think tank and just three guys, three men, three physicists, but it begins to spread and grow as other think tanks also committed to anti-regulatory platforms begin to become involved, begin to support these kinds of efforts, and they do so often with funding from the tobacco industry, but through the smokescreen of supposedly or apparently independent institutes like the Alexis de Tocqueville. Now, why did they do this? Well, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, had recently declared secondhand smoke to be a proven carcinogen, and this result had been affirmed by the U.S. Surgeon General. Indeed, an independent expert peer-reviewed panel of oncologists, epidemiologists, and public health officials had concluded, based on reviewing the scientific, peer-reviewed scientific evidence, that secondhand smoke was responsible for 3,000 additional adult cancer deaths in the United States alone every year. And that did not include deaths in Australia, Canada, Japan, Europe, and elsewhere. In addition, between 150,000 and 300,000 additional cases of bronchitis and pneumonia in infants and young children. And perhaps most worrisomely of all, they found that the scientific evidence showed a clear correlation of secondhand smoke in the household, in the home, and sudden infant death syndrome, or COT death. This scientific evidence was supported by diverse independent studies in the United States, Australia, Japan, Canada, much of Europe. So why would a rocket scientist challenge it? Indeed, why would anyone defend a product that killed infants in their cribs? Well, Fred Singer answered that question in his own words. He wrote, "If we do not carefully delineate the government's role in regulating dangers, there is essentially no limit to how much government can ultimately control our lives." So here you see it, the slippery slope to socialism, the road to serfdom. Today, smoking, tomorrow, the Bill of Rights. And we see throughout their writings the suspicion, sometimes even the overt allegation, that environmentalists are actually socialists in disguise. They refer to environmentalists as watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. George Will, who writes for the Washington Post, has called environmentalism a green tree with red roots. And Senator James Inhofe, the U.S. Senator from Oklahoma, has threatened to indict climate scientists for a conspiracy to lie to Congress, accusing them of being part of a left-wing conspiracy to bring down global capitalism, to which I respond that the left wing should be so organized. Throughout their writings, contrarians assert that environmentalists, and by implication, scientists working on environmental questions, have a hidden political agenda. And that agenda is socialist. So Fred Singer wrote, for example, "And then there are probably those with hidden agendas of their own, not just to save the environment, but to change our economic system. Some of these coercive utopians are socialists, some are technology-hating Luddites, and most have a great desire to regulate on as large a scale as possible." He continued, "More dangerous still are those with a hidden political agenda, most often oriented against business, the free market, and the capitalist system. Of course, after the collapse of socialism, it is no longer fashionable to argue for state ownership of industrial concerns. So the alternative is to control private firms by regulating every step of the manufacturing process." In short, what we see is that this debate was not about scientific evidence. It was never about science. It was always about governance and about the proper role of government in markets and in our lives. And this, I think, explains the otherwise perplexing origins of this story in the Cold War, in a group of men who fought and won the Cold War, but who in doing so took on a Manichaean vision in which communism came to stand for everything that was wrong with the world and free market capitalism came to stand for all that was right. Now, one of the many ironies in this story, of course, is that it's historically and factually incorrect. The U.S. environmental movement has a long history, but its origins are not to be found in left-wing politics. They bear no relation to the American labor movement, the American Socialist or Communist Party, the International Workers of the World. On the contrary, the U.S. environmental movement was founded by progressive Republicans. Republican President Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, the head of the U.S. Forest Service, and of course that famous communist John D. Rockefeller. Throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s in the United States, there was a bipartisan consensus, one that, by the way, inspired environmental regulation in many other nations as well. So much so that in 1964, when the Wilderness Act in the United States designated over 9 million acres of American lands as areas where man is a visitor and does not remain, it passed the U.S. Senate by a vote of 73 to 12 and the House of Representatives by a vote of 373 to 1. In the 1970s, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was created by the Republican President Richard Nixon, who signed into law key pieces of environmental legislation which remain the framework of environmental protection in the United States today, and as I said, has inspired similar legislation in many other countries. But things began to change in the 1980s, and they began to change just at this very moment when scientists working on the natural world, scientists who did not have a political agenda, scientists who, by and large, were not members of environmental organizations, scientists like Dave Keeling, who in many cases were actually Republicans, began to discover things about the natural world, things they did not anticipate, and things which in many cases they did not predict. Serious things, serious problems like acid rain, stratospheric ozone depletion, and one thing they did predict, global warming. And these problems seemed to demand government regulation. They seemed to demand some kind of action that individuals alone, operating in a free market, pursuing their own rational self-interest, could not do. And these issues emerged in a huge stroke of historic bad luck, just as the moment at the Reagan administration in the United States and the Thatcher administration in the United Kingdom were arguing for less government. And this, I would argue, put the Reagan administration and later much of the American Republican Party and indeed conservative and what you would call liberal parties here down under and many other places around the world on a collision course with modern science. Hence then the Luntz memo about emphasizing scientific uncertainty. Now, Ronald Reagan may have had a point. Government regulation is not the solution to every problem. But it doesn't mean that the science is wrong. It doesn't mean that DDT, acid rain, the ozone hole, and secondhand smoke weren't all real problems doing real damage to people in the environment and needing real solutions. Problems that don't go away by denying their reality. But what it does mean is that free market capitalism, like any human system, like any human institution, has its limitations. And the crucial limitation revealed by the problem of global warming is what economists call negative externalities. Costs that accrue to people, costs that are not reflected in the price in the free market, and costs that accrue to people who do not reap the benefit of those activities. And this, then, is the common thread that unites the otherwise rather diverse science challenged by the merchants of doubt. They were all market failures. They were all cases in which damage was being done, and the price of those goods and services did not reflect it. So much so that in the Stern Review of Economics of Climate Change, Lord Nicholas Stern, formerly chief economist at the World Bank, has called climate change the greatest and widest-ranging market failure ever seen. Now, the Industrial Revolution brought the developed world 150 years of unprecedented prosperity. And I don't think that too many people would say that that prosperity was not a good thing. But like everything in life, things have their costs. Global warming is the bill, and that is a bill that has now come due. And as the novelist Kim Stanley Robinson has pointed out, the invisible hand never picks up the check. Moreover, I would argue as a historian that we've learned a few things in recent years. And one of the things we've learned is that regulation can work. In the 1990s, the United States, under President George H.W. Bush, instituted a cap-and-trade or emissions trading system to control acid emissions that were causing damage to forests and lakes in the United States and Canada. And a similar system was put in place in Europe. And what happened? Acid emissions fell, as intended. But in addition, electricity prices fell as utilities put a new and better technology that ran more efficiently. And moreover, I would argue, people in the Midwest of the United States did not find themselves with notably less liberty than other U.S. citizens. We know now that Milton Friedman was wrong factually wrong about the inextricable link between economic and political freedom. It's clear from historical research that the historical relationship between capitalism, democracy, and free market economics is complex, and it cannot be reduced to a simple slogan. And of course, as most of us realize, the energy sector, which is the crux of the problem of climate change, the relationship between energy and climate, the energy sector is not a free market. Indeed, a recent study by the World Bank, working together with the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Companies, the OECD, and the Institute for Energy Analysis, has concluded that global subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, to production and consumption, direct subsidies, constitute over $700 billion every year. So this is a massive program to support the fossil fuel industry well outside the bounds of free market economics. Moreover, that does not include the many different indirect subsidies, of which we can mention just one important one. The cost of keeping U.S. aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf just to protect oil shipments alone, and not including the cost of two Gulf wars, is an additional U.S. $200 billion every year. So we're looking at $900 billion a year, nearly $1 trillion being spent every year to sustain and support the fossil fuel industry. Moreover, if we think about nuclear power, much in the news in recent weeks, we see that nuclear power is in fact the orphan of the free market. It was created as an industry by the U.S. government in the aftermath of World War II and has been sustained by massive U.S. government subsidies for uranium enrichment, uranium exploration, reactor design, waste disposal. It goes on and on and on. So we see that this story was never really about the free market, or at least the things being defended were not really products of free markets. But what about the argument that we stand to lose personal liberty? This is an argument that I think we all should take seriously, because I believe that many people who are skeptical about the evidence of climate change believe authentically that their own personal liberty may in fact be at risk. Well, in our book, we focused on one particular think tank, the George C. Marshall Institute. But towards the end of the book, we stepped back from that and we discussed the whole network of think tanks and organizations that have emerged in the last 20 years and who have spread doubt about climate science. It's an extremely long list of groups, and virtually all of these groups, though, have one thing in common. They all promote freedom, and who could disagree with that? But if we ask the question, who funds these groups, we see that they are dominantly funded by regulated industries: the tobacco industry, the fossil fuel industry, the mining industry, the chemical industry. And if we ask the question, what freedom and liberty is it exactly that they're standing for, what we find is that it's the freedom to pollute with impunity, the liberty to do damage without paying damages. Across the globe, citizens of diverse politics, race, religion, and ethnicity share the desire for freedom and liberty. But across the globe, societies have also always recognized the need for limits on actions that can harm others, whether it's the freedom to kill or steal, or the freedom to yell fire in a crowded theater, which I hope no one here will do. The philosopher Isaiah Berlin sagely pointed out that liberty for wolves can mean death to lambs. And recognizing this, all societies accept some limitations on the action of others, because without such limits, there would be no civil society. So the question is, where do we place those limits? And we create those limits based on our best informed judgment of what the potential risks and harms are. And this, I would argue then, to bring it back to the science, this is why it is so important for all of us as citizens to understand climate science and what it is telling us about the risks and the harms that we face. Because without science, there is no way for us to answer the question about the risks and the harms. And those harms we know now are considerable. They include significant sea level rise and the drowning of major portions of cities around the world, including historic monuments, massive amounts of infrastructure, huge amounts of infrastructure around the world is at or very close to sea level, and of course, dislocation of tens or hundreds of millions of people in places like the Pacific Islands and Bangladesh. We're already seeing increases in extreme weather events, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, tornadoes, and with that, massive loss of property, human mortality, disruption of economic activity, and the worry as shown in the Russian fires last year, of the potential of disruption of food supplies. We're seeing already increases in loss of biodiversity, particularly the Australian Great Barrier Reef and coral reefs around the Pacific. Ocean acidification, which could have significant impacts on the base of the food chain. And one other strange but important thing, the threat of bad-tasting broccoli, of which I'll say more in a moment. So to conclude. In 1990, Richard Darman, the director of the powerful Office of Management and Budget under President George H.W. Bush, dismissed the concerns of environmentalists derisively, saying, "Americans did not fight and win the wars of the 20th century to make the world safe for green vegetables." But the fact is, we did not make the world safe for green vegetables. A recent study at the Leibniz Institute of Vegetable and Ornamental Crops concluded that growing broccoli in a higher CO2 atmosphere increases the biosynthesis of volatile aldehydes and alcohols, which could play a role in altering the odor and taste of the vegetable. In other words, broccoli will not taste better. We didn't make the world safe for broccoli, nor for polar bears, nor coral reefs, nor for children in Bangladesh or Pacific Islanders. And if we don't act soon, it may not be safe for us either.
I might have this wrong, but I think at one point you said it wasn't about money. Is that right? But then it seemed like everything that you then said proved that it was not about ideology, or if it was, it was just money masquerading as ideology.
Right. Thank you for asking for that clarification. So when I said it wasn't about money, I meant for those individuals. When we started this story, Eric Conway and I are both historians of science. So when we started this work, we were perplexed by the question of why leading scientists would challenge the work of their own colleagues. And so for those individuals, for Robert Jastrow, Frederick Seitz, Fred Singer, Bill Nirenberg, we feel very clearly that the evidence shows that it was not for them. For them, it was not personally about money. It was ideologically driven. You're, of course, right, though, that then they make common cause. They create a think tank that begins to get money from other sources. And interestingly, when the Marshall Institute was first created, Robert Jastrow did not want to accept money from corporate sponsors because he thought it would undermine their claim to integrity. But then, as time went on and other people took over the Institute, they did start getting a lot of money from industries, particularly ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies. And of course, for those companies, of course it's about money. It's about corporate profits. So in a sense, what we're arguing is that there's a kind of unholy alliance that develops between corporations, for whom huge amounts of money is obviously at stake, and individual scientists, for whom the issue was ideological and political, and that brought these two groups together. And that's, in a sense, where the power of it was, because the scientists brought credibility. They brought intellectual bona fides, and of course, ExxonMobil brought a lot of money.
I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the emission trading schemes and your view on them, because I've heard people having concerns about how it's just going to end up propping up the stock market and actually making the money for the people who have no interest in actually making things better.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The story of emissions trading is a complicated one. I'm actually doing some research about it now. And one of the ironies of emissions trading is that it was originally proposed by conservative economists in the first Bush administration and in Southern California as a way of harnessing the power of the marketplace. So the idea was that by using emissions trading, you could set a cap on pollution, you could control pollution and protect the environment, but by having a trading scheme, you could give flexibility to businesses in order to find the right way, you know, not tell businesses what to do, but say, here's the cap, you figure out how to do it, and here are these flexible trading schemes that will give you flexibility in figuring out the best way to answer, you know, to reach these caps. So it was promoted in the first Bush administration. It was promoted by a lot of conservative economists in the Council of Economic Advisors, and it was accepted by environmentalists, people on the left, moderates, because it was seen as a compromise. It was seen as a reasonable compromise, something that both sides could agree on because it would limit pollution, but it would also give businesses flexibility. So knowing something about this history, for me personally, the recent rejection of cap and trading by the Republicans in the United States is profoundly hypocritical. And I think that there'll be, in the years to come, environmentalists will be talking a lot about this, about whether or not they made a mistake to compromise. I think the environmentalists who accepted cap and trade thought they were operating in good faith, and I think they've honestly been betrayed by their political partners. So that leaves us with a very difficult question now. So should we try to salvage emissions trading then, based on the original arguments that it was a reasonable compromise, or should we say, well, actually, it was never what we really wanted in the first place. It was always a compromise. And honestly, a simpler, better solution would simply be to have a powerful and effective carbon tax. I don't know what the answer to that question is. I've written a little bit about it. I think there are arguments on both sides. But I think it would be great to get this argument in the open, to move the debate away from these issues about is the science settled or not, and towards why have we not taken those concrete steps? You know, why did the conservatives and Tories turn against emissions trading when it was their idea in the first place? And if they don't want emissions trading, then what are they going to agree to what will they agree to now? Because that's the other part of the story. In the United States, if you ask the question, well, why did they promote emissions trading? What was that instead of? The answer was instead of a carbon tax. And the right wing in America vilified carbon taxes. They mocked Al Gore for proposing what was then called a BTU tax. You know, in the United States, we still can't go metric. You know, if you don't want emissions trading, are you willing to accept a carbon tax? And if you're not willing to accept a carbon tax, then what is the alternative? Because we need to do something. We've lost 20 years here, and we need to do something soon. My own personal view is I don't think it even matters what we do. I just think we need to do something. We need to move forward on this issue, and we need to break the logjam that we've been stuck in for 20 years, in part because of this campaign of doubt, which has left so many people confused about whether or not the issue is even real. With that note, I see that my time is up, so I'd like to thank you all for coming today. It's been a pleasure.
This audio is from Radio New Zealand. To find out more, visit radionz.co.nz.